In 1938, Hollywood released a movie called Robin Hood. There was one scene in that movie you might recall when Errol Flynn, playing the role of Robin Hood, walked into Sherwood Forest and he was greeted by the merry men. And one of the merry men said to him, "Robin Hood, you have come to join us." And Robin Hood replied, "No, I have come to lead you." Ladies and gentlemen, everything rises and falls on leadership. Always has, always will. Doesn't matter whether you're building bridges or roads in Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Arkansas, North Carolina, everything rises and falls on leadership. And this whole issue of leadership will always be a topic of great fascination, great debate, great conjecture, great curiosity in our nation, because it always has. Lead editorial, New York Times, April 25th, 1861, first sentence. It said, "Wanted a leader," and a pretty fair country leader from Illinois had just been elected president of the United States. And then, lead editorial, New York Times, January 31st, 2008, last sentence said, "Our nation yearns for leadership." Pat Riley, the Miami Heat, said last year, "Coaching is overrated, leadership is not." Everything, in every field of endeavor, rises and falls on leadership. And this topic of leadership, by the way, has become big business in our country. Hardly a week goes by that I don't get another mailing piece or a brochure about a leadership conference or a leadership seminar or a leadership retreat. And that doesn't take into account the books that are pouring out on leadership seemingly by the week as well. It all started in 1992. A man named Donald T. Phillips wrote a book called Lincoln on Leadership. It did well. And he followed it up with the Founding Fathers on leadership, and then Martin Luther King Jr. on leadership. And then a pastor from the West Coast, John Maxwell, started teaching leadership seminars on the weekends and then wrote a book. It's the bestseller list, New York Times, The 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. And then the barn door was open. And now they're all pouring out from every walk of life. All the biblical personalities have done their leadership books. You can read about David on leadership and Jesus on leadership. We've got Moses on leadership, including one book called Moses on Management. Has a little better ring to it. Civil War personalities, if you want to read about Robert E. Lee on leadership, or Ulysses S. Grant on leadership, and then we get to World War II. And you can read about Truman on leadership and Eisenhower on leadership and MacArthur on leadership and Patton on leadership and Churchill on leadership and Roosevelt on leadership and Eleanor Roosevelt on leadership. And listen, you can't be in my business of sports unless you've written your leadership book. They're all out there. Bobby Bowden on leadership and Pat Summitt on leadership and Mike Krzyzewski on leadership and Dean Smith on leadership and Lou Holtz on leadership and Joe Torre on leadership. Amazing. Now, I came out here this morning, and granted, wasn't that long a drive from Winter Park out to the Contemporary. But I came out here for two reasons. I wanted to tell all of you I can save you a lot of time and a lot of money because I have bought all those books. There are 452 of them in my library at home. And secondly, I've read them all. And I have extracted out of them all the good stuff, all the juicy tidbits. And I've folded that together with my 50 years of leadership in college and professional athletics. And with all due apologies to my good friend John Maxwell and his 21 Irrefutable Laws, which would have all of you in here tonight until dinner time, I'm really convinced that there's seven sides to leadership. And it doesn't matter what period of history you were leading in, during biblical times or the Civil War, World War II, leading today in the military, sports, education, government, church, leading today in your field of transportation, building, bridges, highways. Everything rises and falls on these seven sides of leadership. Now, if you have a piece of paper, I'd love for you to pull it out. If you have a writing instrument, all the better. Pen or pencil. Lipstick or mascara. I mean, whatever works for you. I'm convinced that there's seven sides to leadership. Need to tell you in advance, this is not like going to the Golden Corral or the old Morrison's cafeteria. So I miss them. This is not where you can go and say, I want one of these and not that, and I'm going to skip the salads, and I'm going to go over here to the dessert, and, you know, all seven have to be there. And I want to tell you, never work for anybody who doesn't have the seven sides of leadership. Never vote into office anybody from president to dog catcher who does not have all seven sides of leadership. Because if one of the sides is missing, as you will find out as we move along here, it's a gaping hole, a gaping hole. And we can't afford that. Now, these leadership experts, these leadership gurus who do all the writing and the teaching and the instructing, they don't agree on everything. However, on the first side of leadership, no argument. They are all on the same page. Total unanimity. The first side of leadership, ladies and gentlemen, is called vision. Vision. It's the vision thing, which came into our vocabulary during the 1988 presidential campaign. You may recall that George Bush the elder was running for the presidency. And his handlers indicated to him that he needed to be talking to the American public about his vision for this nation. And right after that, Mr. Bush just flipped it off and called it the vision thing. And ever since, the vision thing has become part of our vocabulary. But the vision thing is the very essence of leadership. I'll tell you why. Leadership is always about the future. Leadership is always about change. It's men and women who see a situation and say, there's a better way of doing this. This can be done a whole lot more efficiently. We need some changes here to make this whole thing work a whole lot more smoothly. That's the vision thing. And it's closely related to Stephen Covey's second habit of highly effective people. My wife, Ruth, teaches for the Franklin Covey Company. Some of you may have taken her course. She teaches time management and organizational skills and how to use your Franklin planner. And with 19 children and 7 grandchildren, it's not a bad idea to be married to the Franklin planner lady. Ruth is now teaching Stephen Covey's 7 Habits course, built after the best-selling book. And even though I'm married to the Franklin planner lady, I got to confess, I don't understand all 7 of Stephen's habits. And now he's written a book about an 8th habit, and I'm still trying to decipher the other 7. However, habit number 2 I've got nailed. That says, begin with the end in mind. That's habit number 2 of highly effective people, and it is foundational piece of visionary leadership. Because the visionary leader sees the building already built, works backwards, putting the pieces in place to turn that building into reality. The visionary leader sees the victory parade already going down Broad Street and then works backwards, putting the pieces in place. The visionary leader sees the highway already built, sees the bridge over that big gaping gap already built, and then works backwards, putting the pieces in place to turn that vision into reality. That's the very essence of leadership. President Ronald Reagan put it this way. He said, to grasp and hold a vision is the very essence of successful leadership. So if you can't see it before you see it, you'll never be able to see it. That's the vision thing. Now, leaders, when you have a vision as a leader, it'll do 3 things for you. The first thing that a vision does is keep you focused. It's almost as if you have blinders on. You are so zoned in on what has to happen that nothing can break your concentration. Nothing can break your distraction. It's the intense concentration that visionary leaders have. George Washington had it. His focus was so intense to keep those 13 states together, to produce a victory over Great Britain. I mean, nothing could break his concentration. And then years later, in another pivotal moment in American history, we saw that focus again with Abraham Lincoln. I mean, his total focus was to keep the Union together, to not splinter off into two countries, but to keep them unified, and nothing was going to break his focus on that front. So great leaders, when they have that vision, it keeps them focused. Here's the second thing that a vision does. It keeps you fueled. Gives you energy, enthusiasm, passion for what you're doing. And leaders, I want to say this to you. If you're not excited, if you're not enthusiastic, if you're not passionate about what you're doing, guess what? Nobody else will be either. It's the most contagious of all human qualities. I can walk into any office in America, and within 20 seconds, I can tell you the passion level of that organization. I mean, I've picked up on that because it just hits you. It's contagious, it's infectious, and it always, always triggers from a visionary leader who's excited about what she is doing every day, and it radiates to every life. A few years ago, I was up at the NBA draft lottery. Jay Billis was there, the college basketball announcer. He was in that first recruiting class of Mike Krzyzewski at Duke years ago. And I said to Jay, what is your most vivid memory of playing for Mike Krzyzewski at Duke? And Jay thought for a minute and he said, well, my first year there, he said, we had a big ball game the next night. Coach was talking to us after practice, before the game the next day. He was there in his Duke blue coaching shorts, his golf shirt. And he said, as he was talking about this game the next night, he said, every piece of skin that was exposed, legs, arms, neck, covered with goosebumps. He said there were goosebumps all over every area of his skin as he was talking about that game the next night. Now, this was 25 years after that event when I talked to Jay, and I thought to myself, that's his most vivid memory of his coach, goosebumps. And I'm sure as Coach K gets ready to take on Angola, after whipping China by 30, with Angola tomorrow, the ball players will probably see goosebumps all over his skin as well. But as a leader, when you've got a vision, it keeps you fueled. And then the third thing that a vision does helps finish. Gets you across the goal line, into the end zone. And you see in leadership, in every case, it's always marked by finishing. In my business that I've been in now for 46 years, we call them W's and L's. And they have a very strange custom in my business. After a certain period of time, if you have not produced enough W's, they slide you off the stage. And here comes somebody else to take your place. I mean, it's a rite of passage in our business. Last year, I was speaking in Fort Myers, Florida, and afterwards, I was at the book table I had brought with copies of my book. And by the way, we got a book table set up here today as well. A lady came over, and she was a chatty soul. Her name was Joy, Joy Millis. Never will forget Joy. And she told me a story. She said, years ago, she said, I was on a plane, and I noticed on the flight, I saw Johnny Unitas, the great Colts quarterback. She said, I was reading a book, and when the plane landed, I approached Johnny Unitas and asked him to sign my book. And I said, Johnny, don't sign it like you'd sign for anybody else, like best wishes or good luck. And John Unitas said, well, how do you want me to sign it? And Joy said, with the best advice you ever got from one of your coaches. So Johnny Unitas signed the book. To Joy, win. And then signed John Unitas. So I don't care what field you're in, and the work that you guys are in, you ladies are in, the work I'm in, whether you're running for presidential office or overseeing a war in Iraq, the bottom line, always W's and L's. Peter Drucker, the great leadership guru who died a few years ago at 95, wrote for decades on leadership and management. And if I could summarize everything that the great Peter Drucker wrote about in one sentence. Here it is. Leadership is always about results. And that's never going to change. And let's face it, leadership is not easy. There are many mountains to get over, many valleys to tunnel through, many setbacks, many disappointments, much heartache, much failure along the way. But as I study the lives of great leaders, the leaders that we most admire, very frankly, we never should have heard of any of them, because they all should have quit. You realize George Washington lost more battles in the Revolutionary War than he won. You are very familiar with all the disappointments and failures in Abraham Lincoln's life. When you study the life of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I mean, no way he should have run for office. I mean, the man had polio and was in a wheelchair. And study Winston Churchill's life. Dysfunctional family, fought depression, failure after failure, but yet generally considered the greatest leader of the 20th century. And our world today would not be the same without that team of Churchill and Roosevelt. And you know the only reason you're here today? The only reason is because of a visionary leader who on November 22nd, 1963, took a clandestine mission right over this area, right where we are, in a private plane. And the man looked down and he said, you know, right over there among those orange and grapefruit trees, I could picture a giant castle coming out of the ground where young and old and light could come and have the entertainment experience of a lifetime. And then he looked down at a lake and he said, around a lake just like that, I could picture the nations of the world building monuments to their own country, kind of a perpetual world's fair, he thought, that would bring this old world together. He made some more passes around open scrubland and marshy bogland, and he envisioned a working movie studio here and an animal kingdom here and hotels. I mean, he saw it all that day on November 22nd, 1963. A very pivotal day, by the way, in American history. We all know that. And when that plane landed and Walt Disney got off the plane, Orlando, Florida was never the same. Or Central Florida, or the state of Florida, or our country, and in many ways the world. And as I've studied the life of Walt Disney and written books about him, including one that's here today called How to Be Like Walt, here's what hit me after I did all that research to figure out this remarkable man, Walt Disney, what made him click. You know what it was? He wouldn't quit. He made up a word called stick-to-itivity, which absolutely described him. Walt was born 107 years ago to very ordinary Midwestern parents in Chicago. They had no money, kind of a dysfunctional family. Walt finished the eighth grade. That was it for his formal education. Didn't have great talent. He was not a superstar. And then at 19, he's in Kansas City working for the Kansas City Star newspaper in the art department. They fired him. Said he was lacking in creativity, didn't have enough good ideas. So Walt went out on his own, got on a train with no money, still he went first class, and ended up in L.A., started his own company, and went right to the top, right? If only. Over the years, he went bankrupt 12 times, had two nervous breakdowns. When he finally got a good character, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, a New York huckster named Charles Mintz stole it from him in the spring of 1927 on a legal technicality. Walt was 26 years old with his wife Lily, and they're in New York, and Oswald the Rabbit is gone. He had nothing. So they got on a train, New York Central, Cannonball Express, trying to get back to L.A. Somewhere on that train ride, the only thing we do know, it was between Chicago and Los Angeles. Walt, who always had a thing for mice, sketched out a mouse and came over to show it to Lillian. He already had him named Mortimer. Lillian was horrified. "Who's sissing a name," she said, and sent Walt back to the drawing board. And by the time that train got into Los Angeles, a new mouse had been born. And many years later, Walt Disney said, "I hope we never lose sight of the fact that it all started with a mouse." And I would quarrel with Walt on that one. I'd say, "No, sir, it started with that word you made up, Mr. Disney. Stick-to-itivity, because you hung in through all those tough times." And you know, I'm so glad he did. Because if he hadn't, should have quit about 20 times along the way, none of us would be here today. I certainly wouldn't have come here 22 years ago to help start the Orlando Magic as an expansion team. We would not be getting ready for our 20th season this coming fall as an active NBA team if Walt had quit anywhere along the line. But you see, his vision was so clear in his mind. It was so compelling to him that he had focus, he had fuel, and it allowed him to finish. And the same will go for you. The first sign of leadership always is the vision thing. Closely connected is the second side, and that's called communicating your vision. It is one thing to have a vision, leaders, but if you cannot communicate it effectively, you know what's going to happen? Nothing. That's how important communicating your vision is. So the obvious question this morning is, how do I communicate a vision? Can I suggest four ways? Number one, communicate optimism. That's my counsel. You see, every day as a leader, you get to make a choice. I'm going to be an optimistic leader, or I'm going to be a pessimistic leader. But I would suggest, no matter what field of work we're in, optimism trumps pessimism every time. A few years ago, I went to one of those Peter Lowe success seminars here in Orlando at the arena downtown, 17,000 people there. One of the speakers was Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and he was talking about optimism in leadership. And he said to that group, suppose I said to you things are bad, real bad, and they're going to get worse, a whole lot worse. In fact, they're going to get really terrible. Now follow me. And then Rudy said, maybe two of you get out of your chair to follow me because you want my book signed. He said, but the rest of you aren't going anywhere. So Colin Powell, the general, put it this way. He said, perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. It's a military term. That means it grows, it magnifies, it increases, it multiplies throughout an organization until there's a raging forest fire within the ranks. Winston Churchill, years ago, in the middle of World War II, said, all of us are worms, he said, but I happen to be a glowworm, said Winston. Now, that may have been a little self-serving, but I think he hit on something. So, leaders, in communicating optimism, may we all be glowworms. The second thing we're communicating is hope. Napoleon said a leader is a dealer in hope. And I think George Halas, the longtime owner of the Chicago Bears, was right when he said, hope, hope, hope. How can we live without hope? And you know what? We can't live for 5 seconds without it. If we don't have hope in our life, we just give up. We wither. We shrivel. We're useless. We die. And leaders have got to communicate hope. And you know the third thing that leaders communicate? Inspiration and motivation. Part of our job description. Oh, I wish that wasn't the case. Oh, I mean, this will be my 40th year in the NBA. Coming up. 4-0. I've been with teams in Chicago and Atlanta, 12 years with the 76ers, here in Orlando now for over 20. Just one year, just one season. It would be so cool to have everybody on the team self-inspired and self-motivated. It hasn't happened yet. I mean, just one year, if these 19 children I have, including the 14 adopted from four foreign countries, just one year if they would be self-inspired and self-motivated. Oh, I'd be so thrilled. Hadn't happened yet. I'm getting up in years a little bit now, and so I've come to the conclusion, till we take our last breath as leaders, we've got to plant that inspiration in people, keep them motivated. The ultimate goal is that they be self-motivated, but we've got to keep that fire burning. We've got to light that spark. We've got to find what inspires them, what gets them going, what gets their motors running. It's just part of the leadership process. And then the fourth thing I want to share with you today, in communicating a vision, we talk about it. That means verbally. That means in front of other people. And you know, every time they do a poll in this country on fear, the number one fear is never death, or snakes, or spiders, or an IRS investigation, or a 60-minute truck backed up in your driveway. Here in Florida, the number one fear is never a lightning strike or a hurricane hit, or a gator bite, or a shark attack. The number one fear is always standing in front of a group of people and talking to them about anything. Number one fear in every poll. Jerry Seinfeld was talking about funerals not long ago. He said, at a funeral, you're better off in the casket than you are delivering the eulogy, said Jerry Seinfeld. But leaders, here's my message. Fight through the fear. Get over it. And battle on and do whatever it takes to work on communicating verbally. Because at the end of the day, to a large degree in leadership, that's how we are remembered. Leaders lead by voice. I mean, that's what's going on right now in this run for the presidency. I mean, we are measuring to a great degree these candidates. We have been doing it for too long, like 2 years, right? And every day we were basically evaluating them by how well they communicated verbally, what they were saying and how they were saying it and how effective they were. And, well, he's great with the teleprompter, but he's not so great without it. Or this guy can't read the teleprompter at all. Or he's pretty good in Q&A. But, I mean, we're evaluating our leaders by verbal skills. And leaders, guess what? You're being evaluated the same way. Every time you stand up or sit down and you're talking to two people or 20 or 200, no matter what it takes, at the end of the day, trust me, at the water cooler, they're talking about how you communicated verbally. That's the dinner conversation that night. And I'm simply saying, join Toastmasters, join the National Speakers Association, hire a speech coach, do whatever it takes to nail down and be effective communicating verbally. And when you study the history of this nation, when you really consider the leaders that we value the most, even though they're long gone, they had vision, but the fact they could communicate it effectively, so effectively, I think, to a large measure, that's why they're still in our hearts today. Follow with me. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. This great nation will endure as it has endured. It will revive and prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which shall live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. Fans, for the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad break that I got. Yet today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. I may have gotten a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for. Thank you. Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day my four little children will grow up in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Yes, I have a dream today. When that day comes, when we let freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, every state and every city, we'll be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." Our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws, not of men. Here, the people rule. God helping me, I will not let you down. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. The third side of leadership is so important. I want all of you to stand up. Just stand up right where you are, please. The third side of leadership, people skills. Great leaders have people skills. They have a heart for people. They care about people. They're interested in other people. They have empathy for people. They love people. Eddie Robinson, the great Grambling coach, said, "You got to coach each player as if he was going to marry your daughter." And then he said, "You can't coach him if you don't love him." Some years back, we started up a WNBA team here. Hired Carolyn Peck to be our coach. She had been an assistant under the great Pat Summitt at Tennessee for a couple of years. And in the interviewing process, I said, "Carolyn, tell me what you learned about coaching and about leadership under Pat Summitt." And in that wonderful Tennessee drawl, Carolyn Peck said, "You got to love your team." And that's true in your world as well. As you take your seats, I want to tell you about some people-oriented leaders that have impacted me in my sports walk. I wrote a book 2 years ago called How to Be Like Coach Wooden. I brought some copies of that book here today. Coach Wooden is going to be 98 in October. Greatest coach of all time, 10 NCAA titles in 12 years at UCLA, 7 in a row. And he was very gracious. For 4.5 years, he let me into his life. And on 5 different occasions, we picked him up at his condo in Encino, California, to take him to dinner, 5 o'clock special at the Valley Inn. And then we'd get back to his condo. He'd read his latest poetry to you, play the Mills Brothers. That's his favorite music on his 78 record player. Oh, it's good stuff. Good stuff. And I was always fascinated. He had one modern convenience. He did have a little yellow light on his phone, and he could retrieve his messages. And I always got the sense there were about 12 of them. And I also got the sense about 10 of them were for former players calling to check in on the coach. Now, understand, John Wooden coached at UCLA from 1948 to 1975. That was a long time ago. And some of those players, I would think, are in, what, early 80s? Calling to check in on the coach. And all I could think of, that's far beyond X's and O's. And banners at Pauley Pavilion. Or trophies in the UCLA trophy case. That's hard stuff. People stuff. And you know, if we could get to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where's the North Carolina section? Let me see the Carolina. There we go. I'm an old Wake Forest guy, so I'm right at home with you. My dad's from Greensboro. My family's from Wallace, and so I'm a North Carolinian at heart. And hard as it is for a Wake Forest guy to say this, if we could get to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and spend some time with Dean Smith today, I guarantee you he would know what every one of his former players is doing. He'd know all about the wives and the children who are now grown. He'd be conversant about the grandchildren. He'd be very up to date on the elderly parents in whose living rooms he was recruiting the sons back in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And Dean Smith did a lot of winning, was very successful. At the end of the day, with Coach Smith, it was all about people. And then we've got crying Dick Vermeil. Oh, the media got the biggest kick out of Dick Vermeil. I mean, he'd cry at the drop of a hat. At his farewell press conference in Kansas City right before Christmas 2 years ago, We are told by the media that 9 times in a 1-hour press conference, Dick was in tears, all-time NFL record. And I've often wondered, what was the deal? When I was with the 76ers, our office was right around the corner from the Eagles office. That's, by the way, spelled I-G-G-L-E-S in Philadelphia. I got to know Dick well. Ron Jaworski, his quarterback during those great years in Philadelphia in the early 80s, said, if you ever played for Dick Vermeil 10 years after you retired, you better get ready for a phone call around supper time. It's Dick calling to check in on you. And Bill Berge, his great all-pro linebacker, told me a couple of years ago, he said, I did a phone call every Christmas Day from Dick Vermeil, and I thought, does he call every one of his former players on Christmas Day? Man, what a phone bill. And Randy Cross, who played for Dick at UCLA in the mid-70s before his long NFL career, told me a couple of years ago in Atlanta, he said, my mother still gets a Christmas card every year from Dick and Carol Vermeil. And then Randy said, I hope Coach knows my eligibility is up. He doesn't have to recruit me anymore. But when you have a heart for people as a leader, that's just what you do. So let me share with you some people skills that will be valuable in your work. First one, first people skill. Be visible and available to people. There's a tendency in leadership, the higher we go on the food chain, we tend to isolate ourselves. We tend to get off in an ivory tower, hard to reach. But you know, to be a leader who is really special, one who will never be forgotten, it's important to be visible and available. A couple of years ago, I was in New York, standing in the will call line at Yankee Stadium, and right behind me was this enormous man just blocking out the sun. His name was David McMakin. I got into conversation with him. As it turns out, he played football at the University of Alabama for Bear Bryant. And I had to say, what's your most vivid memory of Bear Bryant, David? And in that line, waiting to get into Yankee Stadium, he thought, well, he was probably at the training table. He said the other assistants would jump line, they'd get a tray, jump line, go sit by themselves. He said Coach Bryant never did that. He said he got in line with everybody else, and as he came down off that food line, he said you could see him peering out over the room. He said he'd always end up at a different table each meal with a different group of players. And then David said, of course, we were always praying it wouldn't be our table. Great leaders are visible and available. Are you aware that during the 8 years of the Revolutionary War, George Washington never got back to Mount Vernon? One time, very late in the 8th year, never left the troops for almost 8 years. And during those hard, tough winters, Martha, his wife, came and joined him and led the sock knitting brigade to try and help those soldiers get through the tough winters. And during the Civil War, we'd got photography by then, and after most of the major battles, where was Mr. Lincoln? Right out on the edge of the battlefield, conferring with his generals, generally who had performed poorly, but there he was. And during the civil rights marches of the 60s, and boy, that was brought back in my life about 10 days ago, I did the Selma, Montgomery, Alabama tour on a speaking trip to Tuscaloosa. Life-changing experience for me. And where was Dr. King during those days? Back in the little red brick church house in Atlanta? No, he was out leading the marches, on most cases, facing the snarling police dogs and the billy clubs and the fire hoses that would rip bark off of trees from 100 feet away. Spent 42 nights in prison during those tough, tumultuous days in all of our lives. Visible and available. Here's a second people skill I'd share with you. It's called listening. Listening leaders, they're rare. We've got a lot of talking leaders, very few listening leaders. But a listening leader will never be forgotten. That's how rare they are. It's the highest compliment you can pay anybody. I mean, just listen to them, uninterrupted, with no interference. You cannot pay anybody a higher compliment. And in the process, you learn a lot. Oh, you learn a lot. And here's an interesting little concept. The word listen and silent are made up of the same letters, in different order, of course, but I think there's a sublimable, how does George W. say it, a sublimable message there somewhere. And here's a third people skill. It's called empowering people, uplifting them, encouraging them. I shared a program a couple of months ago with Truett Cathy, the founder of Chick-fil-A, at a banquet in Atlanta. Boy, he's something. He's 85 years old. And you need a translator, really, to translate that Georgia accent. I mean, you cannot understand it without the translator. And it was interesting to hear him. He said, "You know how many people need encouragement?" He said, "Anybody who's breathing." And so great leaders understand that they're to uplift and encourage and empower people. I work for one. His name is Rich DeVos. He's the co-founder of the Amway organization, one of America's wealthiest men, owns the Orlando Magic along with his family. I was recently with Rich and asked him, "What's your role been all these years with Amway?" He said, "I'm the head cheerleader." And that's really what he does. He's done it since 1959, 50 years, just travels around the world cheering people on, does it with me. Anytime I'm with him, he'd do it with you. Doing a great job. Couldn't do it without you. I'm proud of you. And you know the most interesting part of the Olympics last night to me? I got caught up in the gymnastics. I mean, I couldn't help myself. And you know what really got me last night? Marta Caroli, the coach. I mean, they struggled. The little girl got hurt early, and the team was, you could see they were nervous and scared and just weren't functioning quite right. And after each event, they'd come off, even if they messed up a little bit. There was Marta. Big hug. I mean, they had her wired and big hug. And with that rolling Romanian accent, "You did so good. I'm so proud of you." You kept hearing her. So proud. And all I could think of, she gets this empowerment bit in leadership. And I don't know why leaders have such a hard time with it. Maybe they think if they do too much of that, their people are going to get big, fat, swollen heads. Or they're going to come running in and want a raise. Or it's going to demean the leader if they're uplifting and empowering the people. There's some dysfunction here that we got to fight through. I'm convinced that in leadership, empowerment carries the day. And then there's one other people skill that I want to share with you. It's called delegating. If I could go back and redo any part of my sports career, this would be the one I'd have to redo. Because for decades, I mean, even until I got here to Orlando, I did everything. I mean, I didn't delegate anything. I did it all, from Spartanburg, South Carolina, to Philadelphia, to Chicago, to Atlanta, back to Philly, to where, I mean, I did it all. I think the reason was probably twofold. First of all, nobody's as smart and good as I am. I mean, why shouldn't I do it? And secondly, if I've got my people doing all this, I mean, the owners might say, I mean, they're really doing a good job. Why do we have to pay Williams the big bucks when his people are doing just fine? I couldn't run that risk. So I did it all. And then finally here in Orlando, it got to the point, it was too big. The NBA had grown too big, and I had no options, and I had to get into the delegating bit. And now I'm the best delegator in Florida. I mean, I'm pushing everything down. My staff is so into it because I'm just, I got the cleanest desk in the state. And I'm finding that stuff does end up on my desk that only I can do, like being here with you today. I mean, I couldn't delegate this, but everybody else is functioning just fine. And I'm doing the things that I should be doing, and we're plugging along beautifully. It works, folks. It works. And the real issue here, and we're going to be watching the track and field here next week, and we're going to see the relays. And the relays absolutely depend on getting that baton into the next runner's hand. And a malfunction of the baton handoff ruins a relay. And I think leadership is exactly the same thing. I just want you all to understand, you're in the baton passing business. And you've got to get that next generation trained and ready to lead the future of our country, the future of our highways, the future of our bridges throughout the Southeast hinges on how good you are at getting the baton into the next hand. And I just want to tell you this. Success without successors is not success. And if we do not, leaders, get that baton into the next generation's hands, we're nothing more than foam on the beach. And I'm convinced at the end of the day, when our grade on leadership development 101 comes in, if we don't have that next generation ready, we're all going to get F's. So we've learned here this morning that the first side of leadership always is the vision thing. The second side is the ability to communicate that vision. The third side, people skills. Here's the fourth side of leadership. Character counts in leadership. Or does it? We have been in a great national debate over the last 15 years about on this whole issue of leadership and character. One school of thought says if the polls are good, if the economy is good, the character stuff's not that important. The other argument is you can't lead without character. So what's the deal? Well, a pretty fair country leader named Schwarzkopf made an interesting statement years ago. He said leadership consists of two components. He said strategy and character. And then he said if you have to do without one, he said do without the strategy. And I am convinced that we can only go as high on the leadership ladder as our character will allow us. So can I share with you some character qualities just to consider? The first one is called honesty, telling the truth in every situation. Not 99% honest, as one political figure told us over the weekend, 100% honesty. People have got to take your word to the bank every time. I think it's one of the reasons we admire Mr. Lincoln, isn't it? Celebrate his birthday in February. Honest Abe. The more I study his life, I think it was the right nickname. Do you think if his nickname was Crooked Abe, we'd be having Lincoln Day specials? And the more I dig into George Washington's closets, I can't find any skeletons. And he deserves that nickname. If he was Slippery George, I don't think we'd be having Washington specials in February for him either. And isn't it interesting, in the two most vitally important periods of American history, the Revolutionary War period and the Civil War period, we had two strong character men in the White House. I can't tell you how important that was. Honesty and leadership. And that's linked to the second character quality. It's called integrity. Integrity is an interesting word. It comes from the root word integer, which means one, which leads to our word integrated. An integrated society is one society. And even more interesting, 2 years ago, the number one looked up word on the Merriam-Webster Internet Dictionary site was the word integrity. I'm fascinated by that. People either didn't know what it meant or they wanted further amplification. But integrity means a wholeness. There's a completeness. No masks, no duplicity. What you see is what you get. The walk and the talk are matched. Ken Whitten, who is Tony Dungy's pastor over in Tampa, told me at a convention a couple of months ago, he said, the tongue in Tony Dungy's mouth always points in the same direction as the tongue in his shoes. And I got to tell you about Bobby Jones. Bobby Jones came out of the University of North Carolina in 1974, played on our 1972 Olympic team, one of Dean Smith's prize players. I made a deal for him in 1978, traded George McGinnis to Denver to bring Bobby Jones to Philadelphia, and he was just that perfect piece for our team. Strong, godly man, started the NBA Chapel program, and Bobby told me not long ago an interesting story. He said in the closing years of his career, he said the Sixers were playing a game in San Antonio. He said there was a play where the ball went out of bounds. He said, I went chasing after the ball, couldn't get it, it went up in the stands. I had blocked the referee's view. And Bobby said, the ref came over and whispered to me and said, Bobby, did you touch it? And Bobby said, no, I didn't. And the ref said, red ball, meaning 76er ball. And then Bobby said, amazingly enough, 2 weeks later, we're back in Philadelphia at the Spectrum. Same referees working the game. And he said, there's a play right in front of our bench. The ball going out of bounds. I'm chasing after it. Again, I blocked the ref's view. And the ref whispers to me right in front of our bench, Bobby, did you touch it? And Bobby said, yeah. And awarded the ball to the other team. Billy Cunningham, our coach, heard that. Came up off the bench, stamped his foot, and barked, Bobby, don't do that. Let the refs call the game. And Bobby Jones said later, I wasn't going to compromise my integrity over one possession. And then there's a third character quality I want to share with you. It's called humility, a humble spirit. Let's face it, leaders, there's some wonderful perks to leadership. Leaders are famous. They're in the headlines. Leaders are quoted. They're applauded sometimes. They're exalted. Oftentimes they're up on that pedestal. They get lots of privileges, parking privileges, golf club memberships, executive washroom keys. Christopher, ooh, some good stuff with leadership. But let me say this. You know what I've learned? That good stuff ruins more leaders than anything else. So many men and women, Joe, and you've seen it as well, I guarantee you, can't handle an overflowing cup. They begin to inhale all this stuff and think, by divine right, this is all mine, and they're gone. They're ruined right on the spot. I have seen it happen endlessly. And so a leader who can keep an humble spirit, valuable, really valuable. And I would simply remind those leaders about the first sentence in Rick Warren's best-selling book, The Purpose-Driven Life, 30 million copies sold in hardcover, and I thought, why couldn't I have done that? It's a self-help book. First sentence. It's not about you. That's what it says in the self-help book. And I think leaders are always thinking that way. There's a humility to them that I find really attractive. I love it. Nothing draws me to a person more than that. A person who's established and really, really done great things, a great leader with a humble spirit. I do a radio show in Orlando each week, and last year I interviewed Ruth Graham, Dr. Billy Graham's youngest daughter. And in the course of the interview, it was about her new book, I did ask her about her famous father. And Ruth, in that wonderful North Carolina accent, said, "My daddy," and she had me right there, "my daddy knows who he is, a flawed human being." And then Ruth said, "In daddy's mind, he's still just a farm boy from North Carolina." And I thought, I think that's why he's great. Big part of it. Now, the fifth side of leadership is so important. I'm going to ask you to do something for me. I want you to switch seats with your partner. Just flip seats. Quickly. Just whoever's sitting next to you, just flip. It's that important. Just flip, quickly. Woo! Look at this crowd. Look at this crowd. I mean, is this awesome? Woo! I am really impressed. And you know what? My host today, Chris, said you could not pull that off. He said he predicted you couldn't do it. But it leads right to the fifth side. I'm so glad you were able to pull that off. The fifth side of leadership is called competence. And you just demonstrated it. Leaders are good at what they do. And that begs the question, how did they get good? Born that way or developed? I wrote a book. Copies are here today. The name of the book is called Coaching Your Kids to Be Leaders. And in the process, I interviewed about 800 men and women in leadership positions. And one of the questions I asked them, Gordon, was simply this: are leaders born or made? And about 85% said to me, they're made. And I was so thrilled. Mark, if it had been the other way around, I'd have had to call Warner Books and say, no need to write the book, because these people are all born this way. Now, obviously, we come into the world with different gifts, different DNA, different backgrounds, different environment, different parenting, of course. But at the end of the day, leadership skills can be developed. They can be enhanced. And no matter how good you are as a leader, you can be better. So let me take a look at some competencies just for you to think about. Competency number one, solving problems. Solving problems. Colin Powell put it this way. He said, leadership is solving problems, and when people stop bringing you their problems, you're through as a leader. Lots of problems stacked up on your desk back home. Lots of them. I mean, really stacked high. Whew, that's good news. You are in great shape. Your job is secure. You ain't gone anywhere. You're in wonderful shape. Here's the second competency. It's called selling. When Chuck Daly coached our Magic team here in the late 90s, he said to me one day, he said, "I'm not a coach." He said, "I'm a salesman." He said, "All I do is sell. I'm selling these ball players on game plans and strategy." He said, "I got to sell the front office on everything I need. Whenever I talk to the media, I'm selling them, so they'll go sell the fans." He said, "All I do is sell." And leaders, I get a big kick out of this. I'm going to get out of sales and get into management. Then you're really into sales. I just want you to know, you're never out of sales. Never. And as I watched President Bush last night in that interview with Bob Costas on the set at the Olympics in Beijing, I mean, Mr. Bush was selling up a storm. I mean, he was selling freedom of religion in China. He was selling this whole issue with Russia and Georgia. He was selling this, that, and the other. I mean, selling young people not to use steroids in sports. I mean, he was selling for about 12 minutes with Bob Costas, nonstop. And if the leader of the free world is a nonstop salesman, you think you and I are exempt? And then the third thing, third competency, is called team building. Great leaders, I've got to do it as a team. I just turned the manuscript in. It'll be out next summer on a book called Extreme Dreams Depend on Teams. And I am convinced, I mean beyond a shadow of a doubt, anything great that's happened in this country or in this world was done as a team, collectively. The days of the Lone Ranger operator are over. And by the way, that was a fallacy to begin with. He was never the Lone Ranger. He always had Tonto, right? And so to get things done, you've got to do it as a team. If you have not read Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Team of Rivals, that came out a few years ago, it's now out in paperback, so you can afford it, Joe. I would say this. Her point was, there were about six people running for the presidency, all who thought they were better than Lincoln. All thought Lincoln was this ignorant boob from Illinois who could no more be the president than that sign over there. And Lincoln, in a split ballot, he won the election. And these other candidates just were scornful and mocked him, had awful nicknames for him. So you know what Lincoln did? They became his cabinet. I mean, he hired all of these opponents to be his cabinet members. And they were good. I mean, they were the most capable people. And he created this team of rivals. And Doris Kearns Goodwin's point is very simple. During those pivotal years leading up to and then after and through the Civil War period, our nation never would have survived without Lincoln and his team of rivals. So leaders, you are in the team building business. That competency is so important. And then there's one other competency I want to share with you. It's called teaching. You are lifelong teachers, leaders. Anytime I'm with Coach Wooden, he never uses the word coach. It's always teach. He's from Martinsville, Indiana. Here's how Coach Wooden talks. "I was teaching these young men under my supervision." I laugh when I think of Lou Alcindor and Bill Walton under his supervision. He said, "I was teaching these young men under my supervision, yes, to be outstanding basketball players, but more importantly, to be outstanding young men." You know, that's how Coach talks. Lifelong teacher. And at almost 98, that's what he talks about to this day, teaching. Vince Lombardi put it this way. He said, "They call it coaching, but it's really teaching." So leaders across the Southeast, Puerto Rico, here's what I'm saying to you. You're in the teaching business. You are lifelong teachers, and it's never going to change. So just start viewing yourself differently. I am a teacher. I'm an instructor. That's what I do for a living. And by the way, if you walk out of here and this week unfolds and you take nothing home with you, but what I'm going to tell you now, this is my recommended point to take home. I'm saying it in advance. You cannot be a lifelong teacher until you make a commitment to be a lifelong learner. It is so important. And the reason that is true is the world's changing so fast. In the next 3 to 5 years, we are told all known knowledge will double every day. And if you and I are not on the cutting edge of learning, we're going to be flushed out of the parade of life so quickly, all we can do is wave as everybody goes by us. So how do you become a lifelong learner? Well, one way is to go back to school, continue your formal education. Some of you may say, you know, always wanted to get my degree, my college degree, or, gosh, I want that master's. I want that on my resume. Or to be PhD, ooh, mind-blowing. Well, I'm going to say to you, you can do it. And you don't have to drop out of school. You don't have to go sit on the LSU campus for 4 years. You don't have to go sit in Oxford, Mississippi, you know, in 3.5 years. You can do it through distance learning. My wife's doing it now. Ruth just turned 60. She's in the middle of her PhD, getting ready to write her dissertation. She's teaching full-time and parenting 19 children and overseeing 7 grandchildren and trying to keep up with me. And whew, and in about a year, she'll have it. And at that point, I'll be married to Dr. Ruth. And Paul, that's why I'm running all these marathons. You're laughing, aren't you? Now, if that doesn't work for you, here's another way to be a lifelong learner. Be a lifelong reader. Your mind and mine is a muscle, and that muscle needs exercise, vigorous exercise, every day. And if this cranial muscle doesn't get exercised, like arm and leg muscles that don't get exercised, they will atrophy, they'll shrivel. This one will too. You can't get a piece of Nautilus equipment or a barbell or a dumbbell attached to this muscle. But I'll tell you what fits beautifully. It's called a book. Books just attach marvelously. And the exercise, of course, is called reading. And Harry Truman, the former president, said, not all readers will be leaders, but all leaders must be readers. John F. Kennedy said, learning and leadership are indispensable to each other. So how are you doing in the reading department? Well, I got to tell you something. I'm going to challenge every one of you to read 1 hour every day the rest of your life from a book. Not the same book, but from books. The good news is you pick the books and never pick up a book you're not interested in. Doesn't matter how you do the hour, one 60-minute session or 61-minute sessions. Doesn't matter. Magazines, newspapers, trade journals, periodicals, Sports Illustrated, devotional material, romance novels, murder mysteries, they don't count, Ken. I'm talking about real books, and please never pick up a book you're not interested in. But if you'll read an hour a day at the end of 1 week, you'll have finished a book, a regular-sized book. You want to know why that's such a big deal? The average man, upon finishing high school, won't read another book the rest of his life. 85% of all the books purchased in this country are purchased by women. Only 5% of the American public will ever set foot in a bookstore in their lifetime. The Wall Street Journal reported a few years ago that 59% of the homes in our country do not have one book in them, including a cookbook or the Bible. And now author Rick Warren tells us over half the world is illiterate. And I would say, well, we got a problem. That's why I wrote a book last year called Read for Your Life. And I brought copies of that here today. See, I'm out for all of you. I'm out for all of you. If you read an hour a day in 1 year, you've read 52 books. And keep in mind, if you read the right 5 books on any one subject, you'll be considered a world-leading authority on that subject. So in 1 year, at this next convention, you can be a world-leading authority on 10 different subjects by reading an hour a day. In 10 years, when you're back in Orlando, you will have read 520 books by reading an hour a day. And you can be a world-leading authority on over 100 different subjects in 10 years, if you so desire. It's called reading for your life and reading for your leadership life. Can't live without it. I don't want to lug this book downstairs to the book table, so I'm going to give it away. I wrote a book earlier this year called Souls of Steel, How to Build Character in Ourselves and Our Kids, and I'm giving it away right now to the person celebrating their birthday today on the 11th of July, and if there's more than one, it goes to the oldest because I like old people. Who was born on July 11th? Just stand where you are. August. What did I say, July? August 11th. I'm reading for my life. Who was born on August 11th? Any year. Who was born closest to August 11th? Who was born August 10th? Who's born August 12th? Anybody within 1 day? Anybody within... Stand up. 1 day? What's the date, sir? Can't hear you. Come over here. Come up here quickly. We've got our guy. Move. There you go, big fella. August 12th, birthday tomorrow, make sure, Renato Gonzalez, where are you from, sir?
Orlando, Florida,
there's your guy, make sure you greet him and wish him happy birthday tomorrow. The sixth side of leadership is called boldness. Not baldness, sir. Boldness. And I'll tell you why. At the end of the day, leaders have to make decisions. They gather information. They listen carefully. But when it's time to decide, they decide. And they move, and they don't look back, and they don't second-guess themselves. Absence of decision means absence of direction, which is a definition of disaster. And so leaders, when it's time to decide. And you move on, and you don't look back, and you don't second-guess yourself to death, which to me is one of the great problems in leadership. It's the woulda, coulda, shoulda game. If I had just made another decision, if I had only done this differently, you can't play that game. Connie Mack, the old A's manager, was right when he said you can't grind grain with water that's already gone down the creek. And some of you who have grown up on a farm will understand that. You can't redo the past. You can't bring it back. I don't think there's ever been a more decisive leader in our history faced with more decisions than Harry S. Truman when he was in the White House. He came in April of 1945 when Roosevelt died, and Truman had no warning, no training. Roosevelt hadn't even told him about the testing for the atomic bomb. And so, on July 31st, Truman had to make a decision to authorize that. He simply wrote a note, suggestion approved, release when ready. And the next week, two bombs were dropped, which ended World War II. And then right after that, he had to make decisions about launching the nation of Israel, which would have been stillbirthed without his backing. He had to make decisions about integrating the armed forces in 1948. We fought World War II as a segregated army. He had to make a decision in June of 1950 of going to war in Korea. 1 year later, he had to make that decision about firing a very popular general named MacArthur. He had to make the decision about the Berlin airlift, the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. It's unbelievable what Truman was faced with. That's why he's so highly treasured and valued today. During that time, he was ripped up worse than Bush is right now, but years later, we see what he went through. And here's what Truman said years later. He said, when these decisions came before me as President of the United States, he said, I made them. He said, if it was the wrong decision, I corrected it with another decision. He said, but I never looked back. And he said, the presidents who caused us all the trouble were the ones who couldn't make a decision. Boldness in leadership. When Theo Epstein became the 28-year-old general manager of the Boston Red Sox, the youngest in history, his father gave him two words of advice. He said, be bold. And when my son Bobby became a manager in the Washington Nationals farm system a couple of years ago at age 27, he picked up the phone and his voice was up here. He said, Dad, he said, what do I do now? And you know what I told him? Be the boss. That's what I said to him. I didn't say be bossy, and I didn't say be a jerk. I didn't say be arrogant, but I said be the boss, and I'll tell you why I told him that. You know what I've learned over the years? You get one crack at leadership. You get one opportunity to be the head coach, or the senior pastor, or the high school principal, or the department head, or the governor, or the president. You get one crack at it. And you want to know the worst feeling in the world? Years later, thinking, I was always skating on thin ice, always tiptoeing around the edges. I wanted everybody to like me. I didn't want to offend anybody. That's not a good feeling. That's why boldness in leadership is so important. And that leads paradoxically to the seventh side of leadership that locks this whole thing in place. And that seventh side is called a servant's heart. Although I like the verb form better, a serving heart. There are many six-sided leaders out there. They're good. They do a great job. Deserve our support and our admiration. But to be a leader for the ages, one, Mike, who will never be forgotten, a serving-hearted leader. That's a man or a woman who understands they're not in a position of leadership or authority to dominate people or crush them or browbeat them or manipulate them. That is not leadership. That is called assault and battery. A serving-hearted leader understands it's not about me. It's always about others. We've got some examples through history. Wish we had more. Jesus, of course, was the ultimate of serving leadership. Wilberforce, David Livingston, Albert Schweitzer. Schweitzer was once asked why he went third class on train trips. He said, because there's not a fourth. Gandhi, Mandela, Dr. King, Mother Teresa, Coach Wooden, Billy Graham, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, post-presidency, I think he got it. You know who else was a serving leader? Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Senator Robert F. Kennedy was running for the presidency in June of 1968, had just won the California primary in a big upset. His last words before his supporters that night were, my thanks to all of you, and on to Chicago, and let's win now. And he came off the stage, and for some reason that night at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, he did something he never had done before. He went out the back way through the kitchen. And there was a man in the shadows who jumped out with a pistol and shot him. And as Robert Kennedy collapsed to the kitchen floor that night, late, very late, his wife Ethel leaned over, and the last words Robert Kennedy said on this earth were, "Is everybody else all right?" And he went into unconsciousness. 2 days later, at his funeral mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, his younger brother, Senator Edward Kennedy, said this, "Remember Robert simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it." And I would say, leaders, may that be said of all of us. I want you to do something with me. Vince Lombardi, the great Packer coach, is still very much in our mindset today. I think when we think of leaders, you know, we do think of him in the sports business, and that transferred over into business as well. He was a marvelous, marvelous leader. I've talked to enough of the old Packers, from Paul Hornung to Bart Starr to Bill Curry, who's just written a wonderful book, Jerry Kramer, and others, that I can really take you inside the Packer locker room. It's Thursday morning, and every Thursday morning before the start of practice, Coach Lombardi would deliver one of his motivational messages. So inspiring. Talked for about 8 minutes. I mean, the hair would jump, the goosebumps would pop, no matter how many years those guys heard that. And by the way, the players were always standing. So you got to go in the locker room with me and stand up. Stand up. So here is Coach Lombardi. Thursday morning, before the start of practice, he's delivered his motivational messages to his Packers teams who are winning championships left and right. And at the end of the message, Coach Lombardi would bark, "Who's going to lead today?" before they headed out to practice. Who is going to lead today? That's an incredibly important question for all of us. Who's going to lead today? Will it be you? Or you? You. See you at the top. Thank you.
Pat, thank you so much for joining us today. A real pleasure. And for everyone, and I know I will be there, he will be signing books near the bottom of the escalators as you head to the trade show or near the registration desk. So thank you again. Let's give him another round of applause for being here with us. Well, we're coming to the close. There's a couple things I want to go through, and then Kevin will do some clean up in some announcements.